Radio.
The Proclaim 2014 podcasts, recorded by Cradio and XT3.com.
This talk is The Role of the Worship Leader When the Choir is the Entire Assembly, by Paul Mason from the Diocese of Wollongong.
Good afternoon. My name's Margaret Hellman, and I'm going to introduce our auspicious speaker this afternoon. So, Paul, that's why we're all here, Paul, because Paul is a liturgist and a composer. He is currently Director of Liturgy in the Diocese of Wollongong and Chair of the Australian Pastoral Musicians Network. He was the convener at the recent National Liturgy Conference, Lift Up Your Hearts, which was superb because I was there as part of the conference, just a marvellous few days. Paul has composed more than 100 songs and published music books, Mass of Glory and Praise, which I have to say, our diocese has just learnt. So yes, we've just got our head through it, Paul, so thank you. And also Mass Shalom, the revised edition, and Psalms for All Time. Paul has published numerous articles in Worship Magazine, Liturgy News, Australian Journal of Liturgy, and the Australian E-Journal of Theology, and is a regular presenter at conferences. And today, Paul's going to lead us through the role of the worship leader in the liturgy when the choir is the entire assembly. So, thank you, Paul.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that you have some handouts that are key. So there's one here called The Role of the Worship Leader, which is in fact the slides that I prepared. Then there's this one here called Guidelines, Music Within the Mass. And this one here, Ministry Directory. There's an accompanying booklet to that as well, which is to do with the discernment of gifts for ministry. But this one here particularly, when I talk about the model of music ministry, all of the roles of the music ministry in this model that I talk about are in this book. So the guidelines for music in the Mass, the role of worship leader, which is the slide, and then this little booklet called Ministry Directory.
Is it volume two?
And just a plug, if you like these ministry books, volume one and two, so the Diocese of Wollongong publishes them. Now my talk is a fair bit of talk today with some examples, which will be towards the end. And depending on how we go with time, we will cover more or less of those examples. So if I start, this is my guide that I'm going to go through. So the outline of my talk is I want to just briefly relate liturgy and evangelisation, music and liturgy, then what I'll call a model for worship leaders. And so I've already then pluralised the role of worship leader. So it's obviously an interesting title, the role of worship leader. So the first question occurs, who's the worship leader? And then the second thing is when the choir is the entire assembly. And we'll touch on where that aspect comes from and why it's so important to our liturgy today. Then we'll look at some tips for worship leaders. Some of these you'll have some tips as well, which we might sort of share a bit. So I'll put them as sort of a starting set for tips. And then we'll look at some ideas of demonstration of the principles we'll talk about. And then I'm going to just briefly discuss some areas where these sort of principles have been implemented, for good, for bad. As they say, as Father Michael White said, music can be good and music can be bad. So that's probably the most critical aspect, is that the music be good. Okay, the centrality of liturgy. So the first thing is, and this is where we find our first worship leader, that the liturgy is the public participation in the ongoing work of Christ to the glory of God. That's in our catechism. It's in other places as well. And that work is worship, proclamation of the gospel, and active charity. So here we see that the worship leader is Christ. We also are familiar with the term summit and source. It occurs in two of the church's constitutions from the Vatican II. So we know it is in the Constitution on Sacred Liturgy. Sacrosanctum Concilium. Liturgy is summit and source of the Church's activity. It also occurs in Lumen Gentium, which is the constitution on the church. There, it's a little bit different. There, it's a specific liturgy, which is the Eucharist. The Eucharist is source and summit of Christian life. Now, they're worth pondering, both of those phrases. Sometimes they seem to be overdone. Source and summit. Yep, we all know it's source and summit. Then, of course, every now and then there's some reactionaries who say, well, you know, do you really need the liturgy or, you know, Sunday to be a good Catholic? And yet here, in two of the Church's constitutions, it says source and summit. And particularly I like the one in Lumen Gentium where it talks about it's the source and summit of Christian life. And you get this idea of sort of a movement. There's a pulsation. There's source and there's summit. And that's from Sunday to Sunday. What I find refreshing is, and people wouldn't refer to Evangelii Gaudium as a liturgical document. It's pretty transparent. But right at the heart of the joy of the gospel, in clause 24 or paragraph 24, here it says, the church evangelizes and is herself evangelized through the beauty of the liturgy, which is both a celebration of the task of evangelization, i.e. the summit, and the source of her renewed self-giving. And then further, an evangelizing community is filled with joy. It knows how to rejoice always. It celebrates every small victory, every step forward in the work of evangelization. Evangelization with joy becomes beauty in the liturgy. So it's the joy that we bring to the liturgy that is the beauty of the liturgy, as part of our daily concern to spread goodness. So when we think of that in terms of what Michael White said this morning, firstly, you know, what are we doing? Why are we here? We're here to evangelize. We're here to make disciples. Then if you put into that context this whole aspect of joy when we gather, and that joy is the beauty of our liturgy, that to me is really a measure of what this whole idea of summit and source is. So there it is, right in the heart of Evangelii Gaudium, the liturgy. And then of course it goes on to discuss some pretty important parts of presiding, of messaging through homilies and things like that. So it's actually, it is a document that deals with a lot of what liturgy is concerned with. I'm now going to bounce back to another document which came out at the same time as Vatican II, which was the instruction on music in the liturgy. So there were a number of instructions that came out, five instructions. There's an instruction on music in the liturgy. It's called Musicum Sacrum. In there it says, number 16, one cannot find anything more religious and more joyful in sacred celebrations than a whole congregation expressing its faith and devotion in song. So this whole idea of singing in our liturgy is really an important part of how we make the occasion joyful, how we show our joy in evangelization, and that drives us forward and empowers us to evangelize in the coming week. And I sort of go over some ground about music. Michael says there's music, there's message, and there's ministers as the three key things. But quite regularly, and you'll come across this yourselves, no doubt, well, I don't think they want music at this mass. We'll have a quiet mass. We won't sing the mass parts because that takes too much time, or something like that. So there is still this kind of pushback in terms of music. And you see it in other areas as well in church life. But an important thing is to say, okay, where does the idea of music in liturgy come from? And I'll start with our models for singing, which is Jesus and the apostles. So there it is in Scripture, in Matthew and in Mark. And they came out of the Last Supper singing. And then elsewhere in the Acts of the Apostles, you'll see Paul and Silas singing psalms in a jail. In many of the books of the New Testament, there's great encouragement from the apostles about singing. When you gather, have a psalm, you know, have a letter, have something, a reading from the Word, but also sings psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. So it enunciates all sorts of different kinds of songs that might be part of that singing in liturgy when they gather. And then the other aspect about the New Testament is it's just full of hymns. So it's not an accident that the Magnificat and the Benedictus and the Glory Be, the Gloria, they come from Scripture. They're embedded in our Gospels and our Epistles. So many songs. And those songs would have been there. Really, it was not as if Paul was a lyricist. These were songs that were being sung. And they're embedded in our New Testament. So there's great evidence that music is an absolutely important part of the church. And its gathering. Then since Vatican II, there's been a great deal said about music and about active participation in the liturgy. And of course, before Vatican II, if we go back to before really the 1950s period, you had the high mass and the low mass, and you had Missa Cantata, so there were different forms of mass, whether you had singing in or not. And in most places, there wasn't any singing. Because it was in Latin, or people weren't capable, whatever. So a huge generation grew up with no singing in the liturgy. And then, of course, in the 50s, Pope allowed for the introduction of hymns, four hymns. Entrance, offertory, communion, and recession. And that was probably the biggest thing that happened in terms of music in the liturgy. And it's been good and bad. So it got people singing, but they were singing things that weren't necessarily part of the liturgy. So when the vernacular liturgy came into being, there was this tension between what people were used to singing and then what people were being asked to sing, which was the liturgy itself. So every aspect of the liturgy has notes. So there's, if you look in the missal that the priest has, all these notes in there that you can sing for just about any prayer that's in the Mass. So interestingly, when we talk about full conscious active participation, what does it say in the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy? It says, to promote active participation, the people should be encouraged to take part by means of acclamations, responses, psalmody, antiphons and songs. In other words, sing the liturgy. And then the next part it talks about is postures and gestures. So, and the postures and gestures we generally have. People generally stand and kneel and sit when everybody else does. And their gestures, whether it's the sign of peace and a few other things, the sign of the cross, people do that as a body. So that's a body of Christ doing something together in unity. But it's the singing thing, and yesterday I was in a mass, which was an education mass, and I would have thought that everybody who was in that mass, you know, was probably Catholic or some relative to a Catholic. But there are people in the congregation with their arms folded. Right? And it's the holy, holy. And stuck together. They're uncomfortable. I don't know, you know, how they feel. I get the sense that they're not happy. They might be angry, and that's the way they are. They don't want to be told that they should sing something like that. And yet that's a really important issue that is still there 50 years on, and it's an issue that we have to deal with. So So if I turn over the page, I've got Christopher Wilcock teaching a bunch of people. That's what it's about. The people need to be taught to find their voice. That's part of discipleship. You're going to follow Jesus, you're going to sing. It doesn't mean that you have to be a great singer, but that, you know, and with your spirit, people can sing that. People can sing the Our Father as we did today. And they will. It's an interesting one, the Our Father, people do sing more than they might sing some other things. But one of the roles of worship leaders is to find strategies to engage the assembly, the people, in finding their voice, in being able to express themselves in the liturgy in singing. So it's not quite an option. And it's not a matter of, for these customers they like it quiet, so we'll have a quiet mass, and for these customers they like it high, so we'll have a high mass. It's for everybody, in every liturgy. So I talked about many worship leaders, and of course we began with that principal worship leader, which is Jesus Christ. And in Christ, that's how we come to be involved in liturgy, in the work of Him, ongoing in the world, to the praise of God the Father. And we are temples of the Holy Spirit. It's a Trinitarian thing we're involved in. So we start there, and then we find that we have other worship leaders. So we obviously have the priest presider. And if we have a deacon, we have a deacon. And he has a role in leadership, in the worship, in announcements, in the gospel proclamation. Then we have the cantor of the psalm, or the psalmist. Then there's another role, which is not the psalm, but being a cantor to lead in certain other liturgical music parts of the Mass. And I'll talk a bit more about that cantor role. Then there's this the choir or scholar and the choir director. And then, of course, the choir themselves and the musicians. Now, so there's an array of ministries there. They all have a different part to play, which is sort of spelt out in the general instruction in the Roman Missal and elsewhere. But the thing about this is that this gets driven home with John Paul II's Chirograph on Sacred Music, which he put together in 2003. But and this is the thing to do with the assembly being the choir. You'll find, and I originally sort of found it in a history book on Orthodox Byzantine music, but there the word chorus, C-H-O-R-O-S, Greek word meaning choir, was actually interchangeable with the word ecclesia, which means church or assembly. And they were considered to be synonymous. Then again, I read it also in Joseph Gelinau's book, that there was this synonymous relationship between choir and church or assembly. Now, that's where we get this idea of the assembly being the choir. Then you've got the scholar or the special group, and they have a specialist role. But it's the assembly itself that is the group that is singing the liturgy. And this, by the way, I've just seen lately, is available again in St. Paul's Book and Media in Sydney. And it's a great book if you've never come across it. Liturgical Assembly, Liturgical Song by Joseph Gelinau. The next thing that, John Paul introduced in the Chirograph was this idea, from the smooth coordination of all, the priest celebrant and the deacon, the acolytes, the altar servers, the readers, the psalmist, the scholar, the musicians, the cantor, and the assembly. From the smooth coordination of all flows the proper spiritual atmosphere, which makes the liturgical moment truly intense, shared in, and fruitful. So we like our liturgies to be fruitful. Now, this, when you hear that, of course, who is doing that coordination? And it's not very clear anywhere. But if we did coordinate it smoothly, then things would be truly intense and fruitful. That is what John Paul II is sort of exhorting us to. He goes on to say that the musical aspect of liturgical celebrations cannot, therefore, be left to improvisation or to the arbitration of individuals, but must be well conducted and rehearsed in accordance with the norms and the competencies resulting from a satisfactory liturgical formation. Sometimes this is not well understood either, that there are so many good musicians among our parishes who are not necessarily that familiar with the liturgy. And so part of our role is to, in fact, draw them into an understanding of the liturgy so that they can understand how the music applies in the liturgical context. So, and to leave it to improvisation, which is a lot, I would suggest, the way a lot of our masses actually happen. So we had an improvised singing of the Our Father today, but our mass today was pretty good, you know. But there'll be other times where there'll be all sorts of improvisation going, because there's a worship leader here, and there's another worship leader over here on the organ, and another worship leader over there. And the issue is, they're all worship leaders, but there does need to be some kind of coordination, and people need to have that, they need to have those sort of roles clarified. So that brings me to this model for worship leaders, particularly within the context of the music ministry. So there's this diagram. So, of course, in the context of a parish, we have the pastoral leadership of the parish. But then within the music and then within each mass. So in the mass, all of those ministers that Pope John Paul II spoke about are included in this oval. And then what I've placed in there is a thing called a music coordinator. So it's not a role that's in any book. But it's a role that must be there if we're going to have some smooth coordination. Then I've got a couple of other roles here, which are more background type roles that function in the background. They're not happening actively in mass, but unless they're there, then things are going to fall down. There's the music director role. People sometimes don't like the idea that there's a director of music ministries, but you know, a parish might have 60 to 100 people involved in music ministries or more, and somebody needs to, you know, roster them, talk to them, find new ones, replace old ones, a whole lot of things that need to go on in terms of music ministry. I've got another role here called voice trainer. And this is a role that I've been working with probably for 20 years now. It's the idea that, well, the cantor is going to be an important part of our ministry. And cantors come from the assembly, right? You'll want, you know, better than average voices, but they're not going to be perfect. They don't need a music degree, but what they do need is voice training so that they learn repertoire and they also learn to enunciate properly, breathe properly, to sing properly, to pitch properly, all of those sorts of things. And that's the role of a voice trainer. And then there's another one, music administrator, which was looking after all of the music copies and copyright and various other things to do with administration of the music ministry. So that's our little model. And then I wanted to particularly talk about in that these aspects of these worship leaders. I've got another diagram, which is the bottom part of that diagram. And here, this is what we've implemented in Wollongong, is that we have some support structures here to help support that kind of a model. So diocesan support. So we provide for scholarships. It's something that we used to do in a couple of the parishes that I was involved in. We would pay voice trainers to train cantors. And so the diocese offers money to people who will, you know, take on the role of cantor and voice trainer. So we'll pay a subsidy, sort of around about 50% of a lesson, that'll come from the diocese to help encourage that kind of activity to occur. And a few other, we provide some repertoire guidance, and we have a sort of an artist in residence program where we'll go in and look at trying to help shape a parish ministry. The Australian Pastoral Musicians Network, so they're a support organisation to this kind of idea or model of music ministry. And we're also looking at a course that's starting, not 2013, but February 2015, which is a certificate course in pastoral liturgy, which includes a music component. So it's all, yeah, you can have all of those things, have your music coordinator, but you still need other support mechanisms for this model, model of music ministry. But what it does do then is it then provides, I guess, an environment so that you can achieve some coordination of the worship leaders, the many worship leaders. And that's one of the beautiful things about the liturgy, is that there are different gifts all in the one assembly, different ministries all in that one assembly. And this is what we mean by worship leadership in, you know, our Catholic liturgical tradition. So now, another important thing that I think needs to be considered to make this model for music ministry work is what goes on with the places for the music leaders. Sometimes in some churches this can be a crippling thing. It can really stymie any effort to try and activate, you know, the assembly to sing. So we have the idea that there's an altar, and a lot of the ministry that a presider or a deacon does is from the altar. So they're singing from the altar. And as I said, anything, any prayer, like even the, so the presidential prayers, so the prayer over the gifts, they can be sung. Certainly the dialogues that happen and the preface and all those sorts of things can be sung. So they don't have to be sung, but they can be sung. It's part of it. And they do that from the altar. Then there's also the chair, again for the presider. So, and the presider has a critical role in activating the participation of the people, because no one's going to sing "End with Your Spirit" unless the presider sings "The Lord Be with You." And so that's just one example. But there are a number of things in the liturgy that will only be sung by the assembly if the presider leads it. And Peter Comensoli, he's got a nice voice. He doesn't sort of bellow it, but he keeps on pitch pretty well. Bishop Peter Ingham, he'll sing anything that he'll give a go at. He's not a great singer of any note, but he will sing. And so I think it's very important. If you look at how many parts of the Mass are responses to the presider, it is very important that the priest takes on some of that. There are also parts where there are acclamations, so the priest and the people are singing together. It might be the Holy Holy, but whatever it is, they're doing that thing together, and so are the altar servers, and you know, anybody else who's within sight. And I had, I might find it in one of these diagrams here, there's a picture of a cantor at the lectern, and in the background you can see one of the acolytes, and he's singing his heart out, mm-hmm. right? But that's really important, because that's part of what makes it joyful, makes it welcoming and inviting, is that they're all participating. So if we're all singing Holy Holy, well, you know, the priest needs to sing it and the acolyte needs to sing it. Those are really important principles. We have another place, which is the ambo, and that's particularly meant for the word, obviously. And so the cantor of the psalm and the deacon minister and lead worship from that position. So the thing that's referred to as an other suitable place in the various documents, so whether it's the ceremonial of bishops or the various documents, will refer to another place. There needs to be another place other than the altar, the chair and the ambo for leading worship. And that's for the cantor, and in the ceremonial of bishops it refers to the choir director. So, and at our mass today you would have seen a smaller lectern over by the seat, the bishop's seat, which was on the ground level. It could be on a stepped up level or whatever. Whatever makes that role visible. Because it's an important thing. If you're leading the Lord have mercy, and that's a dialogue or a litany, then there is a cantor involved. Cantor needs to be able to be seen. Their gestures need to be able to be seen. Of course, they need to be able to be heard. So that's why they nominate this other place. Now, some churches have no other place. And that's unfortunate. So one thing would be to look to see if you can establish that other place. Yes.
This other place, would it be suitable to use the where the choir is at the back?
Ah, good question. So, I say no. So the choir can sing from the choir loft, but if somebody is leading the assembly in like a litany, then the best place for that to be is within visibility. So that's why they refer to this other place that the cantor would sing from. And part of that is because if it is a dialogue sort of response type thing, then people are responding to something. If they just hear it, it's just a voice. It's a disembodied voice. You can't see the person. And it's important. Just like when we're responding to the priest in a dialogue, it's important that we see him. So I know that sometimes the people have constraints and they have to do with whatever they can. But really, the ideal for those sorts of circumstances is this other place that is suitable. And suitable means being visible. Mm-hmm. Paul?
Paul, in the list of worship leaders on page 11, these are leaders using their voices, but do you consider instrumentalist leaders as well, like keyboard players?
It's true, but then I'm going to go on to another page. So an accompanist, an organist on their own can provide some kind of leadership. If there's no other body there, if there's no other person there. But I think what we're still wanting is the voice. So the voice is the primary instrument. And so in those circumstances where we just have the organ and then the people singing, there's still, you can do some leadership of the assembly with an organ. A good accompanist can do that. Nonetheless, and certainly with hymns. So with hymns and songs, that works quite well. But with a lot of the other parts of the Mass, it doesn't work so well. And you need that other element, which is the cantor. So yes, amongst the worship leaders, I've got the musicians there being the organists, so they are part of that role, but the voice, and I think, get ahead of myself again. In two pages time, I'm gonna answer something else related to that question, so we'll deal with it then. Okay. So now we're on to what I'll call tips for worship leaders. So the first tip is, get the chain of command right. So designate, if we're going to try and coordinate the smooth coordination, to have a fruitful liturgy, the smooth coordination of all those people doing different singing roles, then designate a music coordinator. Oftentimes, someone takes this role on sort of as de facto because, someone has to do at least the basics of coordinating. So, and often that might be an organist or it might be a cantor. But they take that on that role on, but then at the first instant, when the lines aren't clear, then it'll come apart, because someone will come in and say, "Well, I'm doing this. You might have prepared that, but I'm doing this." And so that's why I think it is an important thing to have clarified that there is this role. It's called a music coordinator. They put in, you know, some heavy preparation to do that, and so that's why it should be designated.
Paul, would you see that person being part of the team as well?
Yes. Yep.
Like there's due preparation and
stuff. Yeah. I mentioned this clear accountability, and then that draws into the parish pastoral leadership. So this draws into the liturgy committee or liturgy team, a parish liturgy team. So there needs to be established means of communication. Sometimes it's meetings, and they attend meetings, or sometimes it's in some other kind of way. But there needs to be some understanding as to how those different groups communicate. The next thing is welcome, invite, and encourage. And it's good that we have welcome ministers in the car park. It's better that we have welcome ministers in the foyers, making sure that everybody has the worship guidebook or the hymnal. Because if you're in the pews and someone asks you to sing, where do you go? So somehow or other, it needs to be communicated, particularly if we're trying to reach out to those who don't come, that there is a clear way of making it understood that this is what we do here. You know, you have a hymnal, take the hymnal with you, go to your pew. Or there's this worship book, you know, or it might be in the bulletin, and they put all of the things that are going to be in the worship and in the singing clearly in a booklet or something like that. So, and then the third thing is, you might want to say something about that at the start of Mass. So, usually someone says something. Well, not always. Sometimes it's just a bell. And everybody who knows what goes on here knows what to do. And all those that don't feel, what does that bell mean? So, it's probably better to say something. And that's where you can be, you know, welcoming and inviting. And I would put that down as one of those areas that this Cantor ministry has an important role in. And I'll start to talk about what I'll call genre priorities in a minute, and just talk about what's effective in terms of having the people participate. So then there's leading with gestures, eye contact, and joyful expressions of the gospel. So we're starting to talk about things that are going to make a joyful liturgy. But you can see that some of these things are to do with visibility, not hearing it, but visibility. So, which brings out this role of cantor, which I'll talk about further. And then the other thing is, which Michael White also referred to, don't give up. sometimes it can be very discouraging. Sometimes you've got, someone who has a higher opinion of their capabilities than what their capabilities might be, as Michael White expressed it. So there are always going to be, you know, various times of difficulty. And, you know, the people aren't singing or whatever it is. Don't give up. So keep, you know, reflect on it. Discuss it. Talk about it with the pastor. Talk about it in a liturgy team meeting. What's right? What's wrong? What do we throw out? What do we need to find? So find the strategies that are going to work for you to activate the assembly in its singing. Part of those strategies is what I'm going to talk about here. And in that guidelines book, which talks about a lot of different things, one aspect there is what it talks about as the liturgical song forms. And there's acclamations, cantillations, dialogues, hymns, litanies, processional songs, responsorial psalms. The interesting thing is, out of all of those, there's only two hymns in a Mass, really. And they are the Gloria, which we we don't sing all the time. And then the song after communion, which we also don't sing all the time. They're optional. So, but they are designated hymn spots, which is all we do is sing a hymn. And we don't do anything else. Everything else is some music which is accompanying some other ritual element. So when we have an entrance hymn or an offertory hymn or whatever, the purpose of what's going on there is also tied up with what's going on ritually. So if the ministers are coming in and then they take their positions, if there's an offertory procession, the bread and wine are coming up and the money offering or whatever's coming up in that procession. So the music that's related to those activities needs to be thought about a bit deeper than a hymn, because it needs to be coordinated with that actual ritual action. And that's where we get these processional songs. So we often sing hymns, and particularly, St. Louis Jesuit type hymns and whatever, hymns that have a refrain or an antiphon, so that there's a repeating chorus and then verses. Often we sing those kinds of hymns for a processional song. We did that with our communion hymn. We did it with our entrance hymn today. So they had a refrain, take and eat, and then they had verses. And the reason why it's good to sort of be able to understand that there are these different forms of music going on in the Mass, and it comes down to what I'm going to say now, which is in terms of trying to activate the assembly in their participation, I think this is the priority. So acclamations, and it's not just me because it's said in some other documents, but acclamations, dialogues, litanies, the responsorial psalm, processional songs, and then hymns and canticles. That's the order. And of course, before Vatican II, the order was hymns, and so it was completely different. But one of the things that's noticeable about that priority order is that there is a worship leader engaging the assembly. So if it's an acclamation, then the presider is going to be participating in that acclamation with everybody else. So he can be visible, he can participate in the singing, and he can invite people to join in with that acclamation purely in his demeanour. Then dialogues, similarly between the presider and the assembly, but without the response, the first part of the dialogue has no sense. And people will respond to the presider or the priest if he sings something. We had that today when we had the song, let us give thanks to the Lord our God, it is right and just. Sometimes we hear that song, sometimes we don't. But every time the priest sings it, well, there'll be more people singing that response, even if they don't sing it all that well, than who'll sing the hymn. Because they know what the response is, and if the priest is, as the worship leader, leading the hymn, then they will respond in song. Similarly with the litanies, the Lord have mercy, or the Kyrie, the Lamb of God, if it's done in a litany form. The responsorial psalm is one of the things that I found most powerful, and yet it's something that we hardly sing in our church in Australia. But people will sing a short response, as long as it's something that's singable. But as soon as there's somebody up there at the lectern and they're gesturing, and they're with eye contact, calling out to people to sing, people will sing. So that's why the responsorial psalm is there. And then if you think about the communion hymn, it's always a pain if it's a hymn. You've got to carry a hymn book, you're in a procession, whereas something like take and eat, or something that's a relatively simple response that people can memorise, they don't need to worry about the verses, but then they hear that refrain come in, they will sing. Not sure what people's own experience is here, whether you have a similar sort of experience.
greet everyone. This last Easter, I decided to be very brave and sang a response. And the response from the congregation, from the people, was fantastic. They responded beautifully, like you said. The moment you give them the cue, they sang back, and they had not practiced it, but it was fantastic. But later on, I had some of the older parishioners who came up to me and questioned me and said, why did you have to go up and sing? And it was not just me. They went and questioned the parish priest and said, why did you have to sing the exalted? Was it necessary? You've just made the mass so long.
That's right.
I mean, how do you get around this?
It's a discipleship issue. So that comes back to this issue that we need to teach people to find their voice. And it's a whole thing. It's not the musicians. It shouldn't be, you know, the parish priest versus the musicians. So it's something that, you know, it's going to be a hot topic all the time. And it's going to be good and it's going to be bad. But you've got to keep trying and keep going on. And the parish priest and the other priests need to be part of it. So when someone says, why are you singing that makes the mass long? Say, well, what is this, McDonald's? Mm-hmm. I mean, and that comes back to this whole consumer element. You know, the people who are there and what they want and how you respond to it. That's not what it's about. It's discipleship. They come there actually to hear the word of God and to become more and more holy in being Christ-like in discipleship. And part of that discipleship is, you know, how we worship when we gather in music.
Well, we just have we started, starting chanting the psalm, actually Ashwin's last year, mm-hmm. So we've done it for 12 months, and just using a plain, simple, plain chant basically 3 days, so it stays on. But we just had the situation where, we're doing chants, we're doing the mass parts, and, chants and mass parts, basically we've just been told now to, we're dropping mass parts, we're not singing the psalm, we're not singing Alleluia. And we've actually been told to go back to the four verse. The reason, this is the Cathedral Parish, the priest has got some, complaints, etc., because I haven't got time to pray, there's no silence, etc. Mm-hmm. So, and he tried to explain why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
But my question, would it be better to us drop the hymns and just do the mass parts?
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of making time, you're going to find, more time savings than cutting out hymns.
Yeah, it wasn't much. they had no time to pray because they were singing too much.
Yeah, well, then the other important thing is that they have silence. So there are times, sing a song after communion.
Which you weren't, anyway.
Yeah, but so make silence But obviously, sometimes they don't want silence. They don't want whatever they're doing. So it's... But they need to be schooled, and part of that, when it comes to that, it's a pastoral kind of thing, and it's not a musician's versus whatever issue. It's a pastoral thing.
I think, Paul, you're always going to have this division. There's always going to be people in the parish who want the singing and those who don't want it, and it's hard to find that middle road to keep everyone in tune.
The other thing is that there are a lot of people in our parishes who, their main experience of the Mass is without singing. So so it's quite confronting to have to sing, so that they may not like it. And that's why it's probably better to keep it simple, smaller, but have, sing the things that are going to get them to participate. Because they'll be the same people, even if you sing only two hymns in a Mass, they won't sing either. But they probably will sing, Lord Have Mercy, if you build that.
Well, my experience is a parent loves to sing, but the key is finding a song without singing. And I found that even when our musicians haven't been available, I've taken on the role of singing a cappella, the parish will join in if I can write once.
That's right. And part of that is knowing the community
so
and know what they know.
Community.
Yeah, that's important. So pick things that people know.
Yeah.
So then the next thing I had was, so psalms and mass settings. Learn a mass setting. Learn 22 psalms, because that's all you need. because there's 22 seasonal psalms that can replace any psalm. My little comment here, psalm tunes. So if people learn psalm tunes, they memorise the words. And then that psalm will become part of them. So whenever they see the words, the tune will come back into their head. So that's another important thing about what we can do with psalm tunes, which we haven't done. And whenever we need a psalm for a funeral, it's the cremond, because we haven't done the basics with learning psalms. But if people knew psalms and they said, oh, the Lord is my light and my salvation, that's the psalm I want at my father's funeral. But we haven't developed the repertoire so that people can do that. That's one of the seasonal psalms. You know, all of the psalms that are done in those special times, you know, funerals, weddings, etc., they're mainly drawn from seasonal psalms. Then add other psalms and other mass settings, and as you say, sing hymns that the people know.
How do you then introduce
new hymns? Yes. And that's another one of those things about, you know, you've got a glass of water, and how do you get more water into the glass? You've got to tip some water out. So the idea is you only really want a glass full. And however big that repertoire is, that's how big you want it. Now, Hillsong, their repertoire is they produce 3 CDs a year, and they sing, you know, those 30 songs all year. Right? And then every now and then they'll add in Amazing Grace or something that everybody knows as some kind of a special reflection or something. But that's what they do in terms of their repertoire. And then the next year they learn 36 other songs that they sing for the whole year. So it's a bit of a... how much of a repertoire do you need is the other big question about that. And it's interesting to see even now things like All Creatures of Our God and King, or you know, these kinds of songs which are now coming back with the guitar sound. So a lot of the new Christian music, or Amazing Grace, or these various other things, they're coming back regenerated, you know, in contemporary instrumentation and settings.
But as a composer, you must want to do stuff you write, you know, like...
Well, as a composer, that's why I don't do a lot of sort of song composition. I mainly compose texts that are part of... So I compose music to texts that I feel don't necessarily have a lot of good music around for them. And I'm trying to sort of develop that as a specific area. I think it's a real challenge for song writers. They need to accept that we don't really want, you know, the 100,000 songs that CCLI say is in their catalogue.
Yeah.
It's just an unmanageable thing. So, and so you need to do it. You do it at a parish level anyway. In fact, you'll do it at a mass level. You know, that particular mass, you'll find they only know certain songs. It's just that they know completely different songs to this other mass and the parish down the road. And it'd be nice to be able to have some core things that everybody kind of knew and could sing. And we have some of those. You know, and that's how we can gather and do that. So the other thing I had was this instrument priority. So the first priority is the voice. And you can do things a cappella. And the second priority is voices. So more than one voice. And then in that, you'll do unison, and then you might add some harmony or a descant or whatever. Then my third priority or third suggestion would be a percussive instrument. And you might say, oh, what does that mean? That could mean an organ, right? An organ has certain percussive capabilities, so does a piano. But the thing about it is that it's the rhythm, a steady rhythm, or a rhythm that might start and then, you know, so there needs to be something in the rhythm that will accompany those voices. Then some harmonic accompaniment, as we had with the Our Father, we could have sung that a cappella, we had some harmonic accompaniment. And in fact, it kind of gave it a different kind of sound. It went from a major to a minor, that kind of thing that was happening in the harmonic accompaniment to the Our Father. And then the other one would be a melodic accompaniment, where you might bring in... It could be another instrument, like a flute or something like that, which is added as an additional piece. or it could be part of the organ or the piano, where they're playing another part which is not the melodic part. Sometimes that can be very distracting, so you only want to do it when everybody's quite firm in their singing. And then the things that get in the way, nothing worse than slow, drawn-out pace. Distracting attire, so you know, you can be variable, but you don't want it to be sort of so that it distracts from the focus on the actual liturgy. Affected vocal style, so it's important to enunciate, which might have some aspects of affectation in terms of what people do with their vowels and consonants. But, you know, if it's something out of the pop culture, or if it's just bad, you know, if it's nasally or if it's bad vowel sounds and things like that, people, that's going to be part of moving into music bands. So it's important, and that's why you have a voice trainer to help with those sorts of things. Often people have that, and, you know, it takes two singing lessons to iron it out. Microphone. Just the potential to overuse it. So even with the psalm response and things like that, you need to help people and lead them when they're not quite certain of what the melody is. Once they know it, you don't need to sing the response. And if you want to sing there in terms of being showing that you're visibly singing it, in praying it, you can step back from the microphone and you don't even need to sing it, you can mouth it. Hymnal dependence. So the best thing is that everybody knew all the songs that we sang and we didn't have to have anything. As soon as we move from that place, then we find either there's overhead projectors or there's hymnals or there's worship books or sheets. And out of those, my own priority would be overhead projectors at last. And I know that that's not what the trend is in Australia, but the problem with the overhead projector is that there's one person turning the page. And if that person doesn't do it perfectly, then it actually interferes with things. So, and that's a big issue. So if you have projectors, in my music ministry group, projectionists are part of music ministry. They're not another ministry, they're part of music ministry. And it's just so vital that the music coordinator and the projectionist really have strong communication and that the projectionist gets it right, because it becomes the second most critical ministry in the liturgy. The other thing is distracting instruments. So you don't want something there that's actually distracting you from singing.
Just hymnals and sheets, any preference between those?
Hymnals and sheets. I mean, in an ideal situation, hymnals are good because they do a couple of things. One is that it provides a basis for the forming of a repertoire in a worshipping community, because it's all there in one book. You might depart from it occasionally because there's something that's not there, but generally you'll sing from the one book. And that's good because that immediately limits, you know, too much new stuff coming in and then getting out of control in terms of the numbers of hymns that you're trying to manage. And then the other thing is that clearly if you've got hymnal, then it's immediately available and accessible and people can use it. And, you know, if one person turns the page slowly, that's their problem. But it doesn't affect everybody else. So,
I've actually seen in our congregation, we have a round church, so I could be sitting on one side and singing big. And I've seen people reading the hymn, but not actually singing it, which, you know, in effect, they're still praying for the hymn.
Yeah.
And we can't do projection because of that topic.
Yeah.
But I've actually also seen that to be a fruitful thing.
Yes, absolutely. We had this mass we had yesterday. There was a song there I didn't know, but I could read the words, and they were there, and so I mouthed the words and tried to sort of I couldn't really put the melody to it because it was just a bit too difficult. But yeah, I totally agree with that. That's a participation. Even if the voice is not full, the mouthing of the words and the mind focused on the words, that's part of participation. Okay. Now we were going to have some demonstrations, but we think we've run out of time.
Yes.
We will get these demonstrations on Saturday. So these items, will not be all the ends of the earth, but we've talked about it, and you'll see that those acclamations, litanies and responsorial psalms are a very powerful way of engaging the people and drawing them into active participation in the liturgy. Okay. There's one other thing I have here. I did have a couple of clips, and I'll somehow... Hillsong Church, they publish their stuff every week. So I'm just going to go another minute. Is that all right? So they put a video up of their church. Have a look. So their services go for an hour and a half. So the whole idea of being out in 45 minutes, that seems to be a lost concept. But they start, and they have, you know, 20 minutes of praise and worship, and then they have over an hour of preaching. Good luck to them. But the thing is that when they start, that whole welcoming thing, so there's welcomers in the car park and there's welcomers at the door, and when they start, they welcome. And what they're doing, it's a different kind of model, and I don't know that it fully works in terms of this worship leadership model. What they try and do is sing simple tunes over and over again, and they try to draw the people into participating in the singing of those songs. Some of their techniques, I don't know exactly are right, but you should have a look at those videos. And there's a couple there I've mentioned there. And the only other thing I wanted to say was really about implementation. As I mentioned, when I was at Wurunga, and we had Father Carmelo Shibarus came and joined us, and he said, "Where are all the cantors?" And that was where the idea came that we needed cantors everywhere. So it wasn't, because we had a good choir, and we had some good voices in the choir. But the thing was, get the cantors happening. You've got people in choirs, get a voice trainer to help those good singers become cantors. And then we did the same thing in Lower North Shore, and we're doing it in Wollongong. All with different sorts of levels of success and failure and as you go along. But I would have to say that out of it all, people participate and sing when there is a roster of cantors.
Thanks for listening to the Proclaim 2014 podcasts, recorded by Cradio and XT3.com.